This is Good Morning. It is, as session number 8 begins in this teaching on the book of Romans. We've not missed a verse so far. We've gone through every one. We've actually accomplished up through Romans chapter 10. Last night and this morning, as I have I've spent most of my time by myself since I've been here. I've had the opportunity of spending some time with you guys, but with going into this depth of teaching, what I've had to do is after each and every session, I have to go back and look at what I said before what I said, and then see what I'm going to say after what I just said. And because I'm learning as you guys are learning, there's some things that I knew before we started into this, but I have learned a tremendous amount myself. So to look at something in context, too, you know, I've had to back up and look at this in the broader aspect. So as we move forward, I'm having to look at chunks of this forward and look at chunks of it back from where you know, we've made certain comments to see how they fit in, you know, from all the way through. I have had all morning a very strong thing happening in my heart. Now, I'm going to share all of this with you guys. We touched on it last night, so we're going to back up into chapter 10 again. Because I believe it is just that vitally important that we cover this completely. The CDs that we have offered to everyone on download, or you can buy them either one from the Augusta meeting, A Scriptural Peace, A Scriptural Heritage is the name of it. Please, please do get that and listen to it, either whether you download it on the web or you order it, one of the two. I do ask you to listen to it. If you cannot afford it, I will send it to you free, because this is just vitally important. The part of the crux of that is in what we covered yesterday, and it touched my heart so deeply, and then began to do even more so as, like I said, after I woke up this morning, that I want to go back and let's look at this just a little bit closer, and that is Romans chapter 10, we're backing up to we don't have to back up too far. Let's go back up to verse 14. Says, how then shall they call on him whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him in whom they've not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach except they be sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings of good things. The quoting of that brought a comment from one of you guys, which was very impacting into my heart, and that said, you know, Mike, you have the most beautiful feet of anybody we know. Now, that comment came because of my stand for the gospel of peace, and you guys understand that. All right, as I read through this, and I saw again the implications of the gospel of peace. And he says, how beautiful are the feet of them that bring glad tidings of good things. But they have not all believed or obeyed or believed the gospel. And he's talking specifically about the gospel of peace in context. Isaiah saith, who hath believed our report? And that report, of course, is the declaration of peace between God and man. There's a lot of really wonderful analogies and stories that can come into this. I know the story about the elderly Japanese man off of some island somewhere who was held up in a cave ready to keep fighting for his country. And this is a true story, by the way. I did at least validate the story's true, even though I can't repeat it absolutely accurately. And, you know, 30 years later, you know, somebody's on the island and they actually come across this man. He's ready to fight. And they began to try to persuade him, and they told him that you know, there was somebody from the U.S. and this was the enemy. And they were trying to persuade him that the war was over. And somehow he had missed out on that. Everyone in his battalion had been killed, and he was still ready there waiting for the one who was still against him to not only to defend his country, but also to fight his enemy. It took some time. He absolutely would not believe them that the war was over. And that was their comments to him in trying to get him to understand that the war was over. This man had lived in want. He had lived in poverty, seclusion, loneliness, all of the things you can think of, simply because he believed he had an enemy that he did not have. When you extrapolate that out to God himself, you can amplify the mental and emotional distress that that brings way beyond what would have been experienced by this particular gentleman in not knowing the war was over. I made mention to you guys something that I've, for 10 years, I had, and I want to say it very clearly, I very foolishly entertained the possibility that God was never angry at all. I want you to understand that was foolishness on my part. Because here we have, now what has happened, now why, you might say, well, Mike, why has that moved your heart so profoundly? Because this morning as I was waking up, my mind began to run through the hundreds of people who've left the gospel, left off believing in Jesus even. And this is the jumping off point, is because I did not make a stand when we began to entertain the possibility that God was never angry, and people began to embrace that God was never angry. And you've got to understand that at the moment that you believe that God was never angry, the cross becomes empty, void, vapid, anemic. Absolutely nothing about the cross is real or alive for anyone. You know, we all thought we were giving God a break. You know, we want to give God a break here, and we want to consider that he never was angry. But what the toll that allowing that in my teaching to be something that was a possibility, I have taken into my heart very, very seriously. Because I know that the power of the gospel is not working in many people's lives today. It has been put away because of this turn, if you will, in the path. It's not that they're not spiritual people anymore. They've developed all kinds of spiritualities, you know. It's all over the map. But I can tell you it's just as empty as anything, and just as legalistic in some cases as anything they were ever involved in before. The gospel of peace. Now here the very essence of everything that I taught, the very first thing that I taught about the gospel that has led me to the understanding that I have, the very first thing that I taught was the gospel of peace. I studied it for 10 years. I'm sorry, I studied it for 5 years. Now, I've prided myself in that I have taken such a long time to evaluate things. I don't have to figure them out today, and I will take time. And most all of the major aspects of the gospel that I have taught you guys, it has been a minimum of 5 years, and many of them it has been 10 years in looking and examining and weighing these things out before I ever make a firm commitment to something that I've believed to be true after working my way out of evangelical Christianity. This was one, though, where that I gave consideration to something long enough to where that it has caused a lot of damage. And I want to acknowledge that to you. I will still always treasure the time that I give and I allow to coming to any conclusions about these very weighty matters. But this is one where that I look back on it and I think, you know, this is so crazy that I even entertained the possibility that God was never angry, because the very essence of the gospel that I teach is called the gospel of peace. And the gospel of peace is based on the cessation of all anger and hostility between God and man. I think it's the only thing that I could tell you that over the last 10 years, I honestly almost feel embarrassed that I allowed myself to go without being clear about that subject for almost 10 years. Because of the gravity of the gospel of peace, because of the gravity of the impact in the heart to understand the reality. Folks, if God was never angry, that's fine. But the fact of it is, if God was never angry, this is all a myth. This whole thing is nothing but a myth. Once I began to realize, though, and this through conversations with others, which that's one of my processes of learning. I like to hear what other people have got to say about something. But this has been a real point that I'm glad now to be able to speak very definitively about it and tell you. But I tell you another thing: I can't let that does not escape my heart. And that is the hundreds of people that I can flash through my mind, many of who would be sitting here in this auditorium today had that diversion from the gospel not taken place. But it became something of no interest anymore. It became something without real credence anymore. It became something that really did not have the power that it had before. Because honestly, once again, if this issue is not real, we don't even have a real Jesus. We don't have a real cross. There's not a real anything. I have also emphasized the fact that I validate the truth that I believe. I appreciate all the writings in the New Testament, and I treasure them. I really do. Even Peter, James, and John. I still treasure them. But you know that I do accept what Jesus and Peter, James, and John and Paul all agreed on, is that the scriptures are the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. It is not their writings. And as I started going back again after this empty-headed consideration of the possibility that God was never angry, and it's like, my gosh, you know, you read through it, and it's like you have to remove 50% of the scriptures to remove the anger of God and the wrath of God and the judgment of God out of the scriptures. You just have to. I know it's not cool to believe in the anger and wrath of God. And I watched Carlton Pearson. Carlton Pearson was one of them that flashed into my mind. Because you talk about an exciting day for me, and that was back in 1983 when I got a call from Carlton Pearson, and he had been listening to my tapes because three women in his church just kept handing them to him. And Carlton's transition into the gospel was an amazing thing for me. I wept. Openly over the phone talking to him. The thought that, you know, that we had progressed to this point to where that somebody of his stature, I love anybody receiving the gospel, but here's somebody who now would have the opportunity to reach many more people than I had the opportunity to reach. And then it came to that point where that the voicing of all of these people in universalism and whatever they call themselves ultimate reconciliation, and you know, there's a lot of things, but saturated in those movements is we don't believe God was ever really angry. This was just man's perception that God was angry. All right. And when I invited Carlton Pearson down to speak at my first convention, of which this is the third Gospel Revolution convention. And I remember Glenn and I and Carlton sitting on that platform, and those were the words out of Carlton's mouth, that this belief in an angry God is just archaic. It's nothing to it. And then, of course, the follow-up statement to that was very telling also. And he said, and I just do not believe that this bloody mess that took place 2,000 years ago at the cross was the will of God. And so really his comments, and I don't even know why at that time, 2 years ago, I didn't stop and grab hold of myself and realize what the hole was that people were falling through. But this is the hole that people have been falling through. And I've had to stop, and I've had to take responsibility for my lack of making a stand about that and being clear about it. I know everybody has to think through these things on their own, but I do also accept the responsibility that people really do look to me to be sincere and to study these things out. Some people don't study them out, and they do depend on me to put effort into this. I have no excuses. I just simply know that this was a tragedy in the making. And we've watched that tragedy unfold itself in the lives of so many people, such as Carlton Pearson. Carlton is now in a spiritual wasteland. It's just a spiritual wasteland. It doesn't say anything. You can't nail anything down. There's nothing of substance. There's nothing. There may be a God. There may not be a God even. But we're going to still be doing this spiritual thing, you know. Yes, you take away the wrath. You do take away the cross. You take away the scriptures in its entirety. Yes. That's a lot of years. Yeah. No, you're exactly right.
And the basis of our love for Christ is the fact that he took all of God's wrath and anger on himself.
Absolutely.
He never talks.
Yes. And you are correct.
Yeah.
Now, And I appreciate the comment. I do know that I never said that God was never angry. The conflict that I have with myself is when these people ask me these questions, I said, well, I'm willing to go down that path. I'm willing to consider that God was never angry. Yes. Yes. No, yeah, you are correct. I and maybe I'm being too hard on myself, but so but I do know that we've had people that have had a divergence away from the gospel because of a lack of clarity on this issue.
An easy way out, they're already on that pathway.
Yes.
Yeah,
I realize that, but I and you guys know how I take the responsibility of sharing the gospel. And now I'm not sitting here feeling a bunch of guilt about this, but there's remorse. I want people to experience the gospel in its power, not just know what Mike Williams says. And the ones that I've seen to take this, I just wish that I would have had a clearer voice to speak up and say, you know, no, there just is no such thing as a possibility that this was just a people's view and opinion. This is real. It's the scriptures. So I think the thing that leaves us with this great impact of this, though, is the follow-up to this, as even as came out last night. He says, but they have not all obeyed or believed the gospel. For as Isaiah saith, Lord, who hath believed our report? So then faith come by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. So, and faith is, as we learned earlier in Paul's teachings in the book of Romans, faith is the joining in a way of thinking, a gospel thinking. It's not, I believe, you believe, we all believe, but it is actually a... being a part of the faith is being a part of a certain way of thinking, a gospel way of thinking, if you will. So, but when we went through this yesterday, and I saw that the only thing that can deliver somebody into a gospel way of thinking is to hear the gospel of peace. There is nothing else. Now, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace. And so then faith comes by hearing. So then. It doesn't say, you know, and everybody quotes this verse that says faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word. It doesn't say faith comes by hearing. It says so then. Faith comes by hearing. And if there's so then what? We just talked about the gospel of peace. That the gospel of peace is preached. And as the gospel of peace is believed, it can move you into a whole family of thinking, a way of gospel thinking, because that is what brings us into the reality that God has declared peace with us. And that message is the message that this world needs to hear, because in Islam, I mean, it's an angry God. It's an angry God, you know, and these things are there. This issue alone is far too important to vacillate about. And I guess I'm just glad to tell you that I even though I've never taught it, I am certainly not ever going to sit with someone again and them say, well, don't you think maybe that God wasn't ever angry at all? It's just man's perception. I will never sit and go through that little rendition again, because it is vitally important to know. To know the love of God, you must know not only the anger and the wrath of God, you've got to know what that anger and wrath was born out of. How many of you did it really have an impact on you to consider that God's wrath and anger was born out of his love? You see, I think that's why we wanted to give God a break, you know, by considering he never was angry. He was always just put together, you know, and never got angry with anybody. It was just man's perception. But when I begin to understand, like I said, even in the conversations with others, when I begin to understand that this anger was born out of love, I mean, this was a love relationship, and this separation created this anger, and there is no more hazardous anger than anger born out of love. So, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. That's the thing. After I begin to embrace, you know, God's anger born out of love, I actually felt more loved by God. You know, that's you know what? You know, everybody talks about how bad jealousy is. I like somebody get jealous over me. You know, I know you do too. You know, don't tell me you don't. It's like you got that little smile on your face, like, made them jealous, didn't they? Yeah. Why? Does that mean you like creating this uncomfortable position for somebody? No, it's because that jealousy says, wow, they really love me. You know, I mean, it's what a horrible thing to be out with somebody and somebody else be hitting on you and them act like they don't even care. Do you know what you want to do then? I'll just go home with them then if they don't care. Now, that never happens to me, so don't think about that, right? But that is the way the mind thinks, isn't it? All right? Yeah, if you don't care, then here, I don't care. You know, I'll show you. But when we understand God's love in that aspect, it really is a really is an eye opener. He says, "So then faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. But I say, have they not all heard? Yes, their sound went into all the earth, and their words unto the ends of the world. But I say, did not Israel know? For Moses saith, I will provoke you to jealousy." Isn't that amazing? See, this is just, I mean, just more and more, even God not only admitted he was jealous, he knew this motivating power of jealousy. And he said, "I will provoke you to jealousy by them that are no people, and by a foolish nation will I anger you." He says, "You don't know what anger and jealousy feels like?" He says, "I'm going to let you experience what I've gone through." "And I'm going to pick somebody that you think is totally disqualified altogether." It's especially hard when they pick somebody that's not as good looking as you. Yeah. But Isaiah is very bold and saith, "I was found of them that sought me not. I was made manifest unto them that asked not after me. But unto Israel, he saith, all day long I have stretched out my hands to a disobedient and gainsaying people." We now have come to chapter 11. The issue here, again, and let me cap off verse 20, is... this was Isaiah and the prophet's way of helping us understand that the relationship with God had nothing to do with man's will. Nothing to do with man's will. And Isaiah prophesied and said, I was found of them that sought not after me. I was made manifest unto them that asked not after me. Now, this is the very foundation of Christianity, to seek and to find and pursue. And you've got to ask God, and you've got to ask him to come into your heart. You know, we've got all of those things. But I think what you're going to see here in the next few verses is that that is a complete offense to God. It is an offense to God for anyone to think that it's their choice, their idea, their means, their involvement in his relationship with you. Now, he went to such extents to make sure that we would never ever think we had a part of this. It is absolutely amazing, and that's what we're going to begin to learn here in chapter 11. Now, we've learned it in other places also. Remember, even concerning the subject of believing, we went through the book of John, and John chapter 1 all the way through John chapter 12 is the requirement to believe. And it was required to believe. It's where John 3:16 is. And believe, you got to believe, you got to believe, you got to believe. There's over 90 verses in the book of John about the requirement to believe. Matthew, Mark, and Luke altogether only have 25 verses. I say that to say this is where we get the bulk of our information about believing. But we didn't read chapter 12, where he says that none of them believed. And the reason that they didn't believe is because God made sure they couldn't. He blinded their eyes, and he stopped their ears. Why did God keep people from believing? Because God's plan had nothing to do with getting man to do anything. He wanted to select. He wanted to choose. He wanted to predestinate. He wanted to be the one to demonstrate his love to such a degree that you would know there was nothing on your part that you could do to incorporate him into your life or to be a part of the plan of him being in your life. So he even when he laid down the rules, you got to believe, you got to believe, got to believe, he blinded everybody and stopped their ears so they couldn't. Why? Because that was not God's plan. God wanted man to come to the end of his own striving to have relationship with God. He went through such intricate detail, the giving of the law, the requirement of faith, all of these things he went through. But it was for the process of elimination, so that in the end, that the human race would know that the relationship we have with God was done by God and by God only, that we have nothing to do with it except that we are the recipients of this great and mighty love and the grace of God and the faith of God. He says in chapter 11, verse 1, he says, I say then, hath God cast away his people? God forbid, for I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham and of the tribe of Benjamin. Now he's saying, you know, I'm in that seed line. I'm in that line, the seed of Abraham. He said, God hath not cast away his people whom he, what? Foreknew. Now you see, here again, what are we brought back to? We're brought back to God's foreknowledge, God's predestination, God's sovereignty, if you will, in this matter. And he says, "Wot ye not that the Scripture saith of Elias, how he maketh intercession to God against Israel? Lord, they have killed thy prophets, they've digged down the altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal." So here, you see what the petition was. The petition was, how many of them had done this? How many of them had killed the prophets? How many of them had digged down the altars and left this prophet Elias alone? How many of them had done it? All of them. But God said, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I selected 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. So it didn't make any difference what the situation. God said it's based on what? Not the controversy with Israel, but God's selection. God had made this selection. He says, even so then at this present time. So now are we still looking for 7,000 people who won't bow the knee to Baal? No, because this was a comparison that Paul was bringing up. We've already covered this subject earlier. He said, even so then at this present time, also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And who was the remnant? Remnant was Jesus. Who was the seed? The seed is Jesus. So we began to see that because of this election of God, it's really funny. You know, we use the term election. And this is so gospel-like, you know, because, you know, like in your country, in my country, we have a multitude who are entering into election to select one, right? In God's economy, it's only one who's got a vote to select all. He turns it around completely backward. But it's still election. So the election is that there, but in God's election, there's only one that has a vote. And that election is a very powerful thing that has happened to us. He says, even so then, at this present time, also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And of course, Paul just goes, I mean, you begin to feel like you're watching a ping pong match in this next comments. And if by grace, then it's no more of works. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. But if it be of works, then it's no more of grace. Otherwise, work is no more work. It's like bang, 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 bang. Okay, 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 okay. I get it. I'm getting dizzy. He makes sure that separation from works and grace are totally set apart. Now, the one thing that you can also put in here and understand is that grace is equated to election. Grace and predestination, election and sovereignty, are all in the same basket as far as God is concerned. And works is in another basket altogether. It cannot be election and works. It cannot be grace and works. It cannot be predestination and works. It cannot be sovereignty and works. Now, one of the subjects that I want to follow up with on this, as far as the sovereignty of God, is that any time you study predestination and sovereignty, you see that God predestined and was sovereign in bringing about the work of the cross for the redemption of the world. See, and people will tell you, well, God's sovereign. Well, that means, well, he's going to do in your life whatever he wants to do. But you see, that is not true, because you cannot have a sovereign over you and be free at the same time, unless the sovereign is overseeing your freedom, unless the sovereign is the one who's guaranteed your freedom. So the sovereignty of God was completely fulfilled 2,000 years ago at the cross. The predestination of God was completely fulfilled 2,000 years ago at the cross. You see, what has failed in the Christian community is we've taken these powerful terms, even grace was fulfilled at the cross. But we've taken these powerful terms that apply to the complete redemption of the world, and the church community is trying to apply it to your daily life. And the will of God is the other thing. You know, I'm trying to find the will of God. You don't have to try to find the will of God. The will of God was fulfilled 2,000 years ago. And you stand in the will of God. You stand in the sovereignty of God. But what is that sovereignty? God making decisions about your life for you? No, you stand in the sovereignty that has set you free for you to make your own choices in life. I remember yesterday I quoted Nelson Mandela, who was quoting another poem, "I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." You see, this is the reality of the gospel, is that you are the master of your fate. You say, well, that sounds so anti-God. I mean, remember how we were taught, you know, you're supposed to submit your will to God and you're supposed to try to be like Jesus and, you know, the whole nine yards. But the whole understanding of the gospel is freedom. It is not God being in control of your life. And you say, so you don't believe God's in control of your life. I don't believe God's in control of my life, but I believe God's in total control of my life. Do you see where it's difficult? You say, well, in what means do you think he's not in control of your life? He has nothing to do with trying to make decisions for my life or guide me a particular direction necessarily. Unless that's just something that's born in my heart, the only thing I can do is follow my heart. And the other side of that is that that God is completely sovereign in my life, because his sovereignty has placed me in the freedom that I have to choose. So you see, you can't separate the two. He is not involved at all, because he's completely involved. And people will get you in these debates and try to get you to take, because one standing on one side or the other just sounds nuts. But the fact of it is, it's both of them, which to some people sounds even more nuts than taking one side or the other. But it's true. He says, and again, let me read this again. It does bear repeating. It's quite a rendition. "And if by grace, then it is no more works. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. If there's any works, is there any grace? There is no grace if there's any works. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. Grace ceases to become grace when works are in play. Grace is not even grace anymore when works come into play. But if it be of works, then it is no more grace." And equally, these are equally exclusive, mutually exclusive of each other. They absolutely cannot exist together in the same room. They cannot. One cancels the other out. He says that is, then it is no more grace. Otherwise, work is no more work. You see, even work's not work when grace comes in. Grace isn't grace when work comes in. It is either one or the other. It cannot be both. It's virtually impossible. "What then?" I like Paul's "what thens." "Israel hath obtained, I'm sorry, Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election hath attained it, and the rest were blinded. Did Israel fail to attain righteousness? Did they fail to become righteous? No. They became righteous, but not through their works. What made them righteous? Election. Now, you see, do you see how this becomes a very sticky point? That Paul has an understanding here that he wants us to get across to our hearts and minds. This is God's territory. Stop insulting the grace of God. Stop including works. Stop thinking you have something to do with this. Because God so wanted the world to know that it was him and him alone. Now why? Because God's arrogant? No, because if you had any involvement in your relationship with God, you would mess up your relationship with God. God wanted a relationship that when he joined it together, let no man put asunder. Nobody. That's what the whole teaching of marriage is about. It's really not about what we express it as, which is quite fine to do that. But we should not lose the divine revelation that there is in marriage. What God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. And then the divorce laws. I love the divorce laws. Women have no right to a divorce. Isn't that wild? Do you know there's not one law that says for this reason the woman should put away her husband? And it's like, well, I may not, but I put her away. I put him away anyway. So, but see, that's us. That's society. That's quite all right. You know, do that however you want. But don't miss the revelation. What is the revelation? When there are no divorce laws for the wife. The only one who can put away the wife is the husband. So in speaking in the relationship between Christ and the church, Christ is the church is the bride, who is the only one who has a legal right, if you will, to end the marriage? It's Jesus. And do you have a promise from Jesus about this relationship? He said, I will never leave you or forsake you. So the only one who has a right to a divorce has promised you it will never, ever, never, ever, never, under any circumstances, will it ever happen. You had no choice in being the bride. You have to go back and study Jewish custom. The bride had no choice as to who she was going to marry. It was not her choice. It was the father of the groom who made the choice. This is all just gospel, folks. All of these things were implemented so that we could understand with great clarity the power of the gospel. He says, according as it is written, verse 8, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear unto this day. And David saith, let their table be made a snare, and a trap, and a stumbling block, and a recompense unto them. This is wild. Everything that God created, their table, their sacrifices, their ceremony, everything about it, he said, let it become a snare to them. Why? Because all of these things were established to exhaust man's self-righteous attempt at relationship with God. And God foreordained, predestined, that the only way that relationship with man will ever be accomplished or attempted ever again is solely by his will, by his power, by his grace, by his faith, by his strength, by his mercy, by his love. And that's the way it was carried out. To the point to where that God just blinded people. He's blinded them. Anything to protect the election. Anything to protect the foreknowledge of God. Anything to protect that the sovereignty of God, which had selected the entire human race for him to be in relationship with. And David said, let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see and bow down their back. I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? God forbid. But rather through their fall, salvation has come unto the Gentiles. You got to see, folks, that redemption came through fault and failure and repeatedly. It came through unbelief. Redemption did not come through the faith of man. Redemption came through the unbelief of man. Redemption did not come through man's success in relationship with God. Redemption came through man's failure at relationship with God. But rather, through their fall, salvation is coming to the Gentiles to provoke them to jealousy. Don't tell me God didn't understand what jealousy was. Man. Now, if the fall of them be the riches of the world, the failure of God's chosen people led to what? The riches of the world. Do you see that we've got this all backward? And we're taught constantly in evangelical Christianity that you've got to succeed, you've got to attain, you've got to believe, you've got to do this perfectly, you've got to do this. But yet we see everything that Paul is teaching here about redemption, it comes after failure, after blindness, after inability to understand, after complete failure. Now, if the fall of them be the riches of the world, and the diminishing of them, the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? Wow. How much more their fullness? For I speak to you Gentiles insomuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles. I magnify my office. If by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, he's talking about the Jewish people, and might save some of them. For if the casting away of them be the reconciliation of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? Wow. For if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy. This could be, we can apply this in two ways. The first fruit, number one, is Israel, but truly the first fruit that is spoken of in the scriptures is Jesus. He is the first fruit among many brethren. He is the firstborn. And if how sure am I that you're holy? Well, if Jesus was holy, you're holy. Whole lump. And so are the branches. And so are the branches. And if some of the branches be broken off, and thou being a wild olive tree, wert grafted in among them, and with them partakest of the root and the fatness of the olive tree, boastest not against the branches, but if thou boast thyself, if thy boast But if thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee. So Paul's just dealing with this whole issue of Jews and Gentiles. And one thinking they were better than the other. I mean, the Gentiles believed that they were better than the Jews because the Jews had rejected. And the Jews, of course, felt they were better than the Gentiles because they weren't selected like the Jews were. So Paul is dealing with this mindset. Again, he's trying to corral everybody in to one mindset, to understand that this is not about two different groups. It's not about five different groups. It's not about a group of gay people and a group of liars and a group of this. We have to clump everybody together in each and every situation to be able to clump everybody together in the one situation called redemption. So this theme throughout this incredible book of Romans has remained with us all the way through. It has stayed with us all the way through. And you know what? I am going to stop right here and so that we can take up on this at the 2 o'clock session. And we'll do some more. We've only done about 55 minutes, but I want to stop the session here so that we can get at the rest of this with a little bit fresher light. Does that sound good to you guys? There's places where it's just to go further, I would need to go further. So it's better to stop here so that I can go a little bit further when we actually get started back at this again. All right?